Welcome back to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I am entertainment writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor, whose writings on the industry you can regularly read over on The Wrap, and whose musings on the Mission Impossible movies you can listen to on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. He and I are recording this week's show on Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. And Drew, this is obviously a big day around here. On our last show, we were able to talk about your Art of Amphibia book that you have been working on for a while. And just a reminder that 224-page hardcover is coming from Disney Manga and will hit store shelves on November 19th of this year. But what we didn't get to talk about is your other book. And this second volume, The Art and Making of Ultraman Rising, which keys off of the new animated feature from Shannon Tindall. If you know animation, you've seen Shannon's work, the Kubu and the Two Strings. He wrote and boarded that one, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. A lot of it was, he directed as well, but It's a... That's a story for another time. But yes, he did Kubo. He did Lost Ollie. Yeah.
There we go. Okay. So I have to tell you, folks, as somebody who watched Ultraman when seriously, this is how old I am. I watched Ultraman when it made its American television debut. This was in 1967. I guess it had just... there was a 6-month lag from when it debuted in Japan and it showed up in the American market.
Yeah, I mean it showed up almost in some parts of the country 3 months later. I was amazed that they had translated it that quickly. Did you watch Ultra Q or Ultra Man when it first came on?
I want to say it was Ultraman, and this was on Channel 56 in the Boston market. They ran it on Sunday mornings, and as a little kid who loved Godzilla movies, the notion of I get big, monsters tearing down tiny little paper mache buildings every week. I'm there for this. So,
did you have a favorite monster?
Man. No, I did not. Because, okay. To be honest, very early. I mean, you've been researching this book for a while before you wrote it, and so you know the zero production values this had early on. I mean, it was amazing to see them do a kaiju on for a television show. But yeah, the monsters were really kind of cheesy back then. But
they were built by, I mean, Tsuburaya built the Godzilla costumes. The guy that created the show built the costumes for the Godzilla movies. So there's an amazing kind of lineage of those kind of monster movies, what we would call tokusatsu movies today. That's so cool that you saw it so early. What was fun was asking everybody kind of what was your first Ultraman memory and, things like that. So, yeah, I love that you saw it. You were there from the beginning, Jim.
Yeah, well, again, this was what was interesting is the UHF stations in Boston, they were the first ones through the door. I saw Kimba the White Lion on them. I saw Speed Racer, again, Ultraman. I mean, it was my window into this whole different world of filmmaking. And, from 8 or 9 years old, it's like, this stuff is cool.
That's awesome.
Okay, so what can you tell us about this Ultraman Rising book?
Well, yeah, the movie hasn't come out yet, so I have to be very careful. But, the movie is amazing, and the artwork is absolutely stunning. Mm-hmm. And I talked to over 24 artists for this thing. So it's very in-depth. You're going to get all the details you want. And you're also going to follow the story of the film, which, began as a Sony project that was not Ultraman. It came over to Netflix as Ultraman. So you're going to get all those details from Shannon and John and the whole team. And yeah, it's really, really interesting how they put this movie together and all the different kind of artistic styles. I have a couple of things to finish on it, but it is shaping up very nicely, and I think everybody's going to be really happy. Because when you watch this movie, you're going to say, wow, how do they do this? And now you can find out in this book.
Cool. Now, speaking of which, this movie debuts on Netflix 2 months from now, June 14th. And as for the art and making of Ultraman Rising, this is coming from Titan Books this fall. Do we have an exact date or just right now it's this fall, right? Yeah.
It's this fall. You know, you know how the publishing industry works these days. You got to send it out, get it printed, have it come back. I would say that it is going to be more of an awards play more than anything else. So, yeah. But I got to see the finished movie on the big screen earlier this week, which was just
so exciting.
That's
right. You went to the cast and crew screening. That's so cool.
Yeah.
All right. Again, just a reminder, our art and making of Ultraman Rising, by the way, just like the Art of Amphibia book, you can pre-order it. In fact, right now, if you head over to Amazon, you can get it for 10% off its list price. And by the way, if you know, Drew's first book, The Art of Pixar's Disney or Pixar Disney's Onward, that's currently Amazon has it for $30, which is down from its original list price of $40, but still, you know, just again.
Well, you and I are always so concerned that they're going to go out of print. So we have to buy them right away.
That's right. That's right. You know that. Let's be honest. We've learned that the hard way.
Yes.
And you know, and some of us don't get handed the limited edition book for the Netflix movies.
Hey,
what I'm blanking the name of that lovely film now.
Oh, Nimona. Yes.
Nimona. Yes.
I think I only did the Ultraman book maybe that secured my placement of getting the Nimona book. That was what really cinched the deal.
Okay, that could be. Okay, folks. I more news in a moment, but first want to remind you that the news portion of Fine Tuning is brought to you by touringplans.com. If you're headed down to Orlando anytime soon or thinking of sampling the theme parks you'll find down there, Touring Plans can provide you with the info you need to make the very best use of your time. It can help you save time by avoiding the longest lines. It also can help you save money. Learn how by checking out touringplans.com today. Okay, so moving to the news. Just in the past week, we had CinemaCon held in Las Vegas, and 35 minutes worth of Inside Out 2 was screened along with one musical number from Moana 2, and basically the word coming out of the Coliseum at the Caesar's Palace was that the exhibitors seemed very, very happy with what they saw coming from Disney and Pixar. You were mentioning when we were pre-gaming that the footage that was shown, for at least for Inside Out 2, was the same stuff you got to see at Emeryville a couple of weeks back, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was the first 35 minutes. And yeah, I was very impressed. I wrote it up for the site to coincide with the CinemaCon screening to kind of get, you know, ease the load of those guys in the building sweating over their keyboards trying to describe what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really cool. It's really engaging and fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks great. It's widescreen now. It's a 2.35 movie instead of 1.85 like the first one. And it sounded like there was a lot of good animation stuff. Actually, we're recording this show the night before the Transformers 1 trailer drops. So we will have our commentary next week on that. But that sounded, people were really enthusiastic about that.
I heard that. Yeah. All right. Now, where this gets interesting, though, this is a relatively new phenomena. Inside Out 2 is being released to theaters on June 14th, which, by the way, is the exact same day that Ultraman Rising debuts on Netflix. And that's, again, I have to admit, I'm intrigued by this phenomena. You know, Netflix putting out a brand new, you know, highly anticipated animated film on the same day that Pixar is putting out a highly anticipated film, only in theaters.
And both are happening during Annecy.
Oh, God, you're right. Are you going to do Annecy again this year, or?
Yeah, I'll be at Annecy this year, so.
Oh, cool.
Yes,
okay.
Please.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. Well, by the way, folks, Drew will be speaking at length about this new Pixar film in the second half of today's show. And for a lot of us, you know, the original Inside Out made us cry. And so, Drew, safe bet this time around that number two?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Kleenex yes. movie. Okay.
I mean, you know, that Kelsey Mann directed this one, who did Onward with Dan Scanlon. And that the ending of that movie is just such a killer. And I think that'll be probably the same thing. But here, Jim, I have my Inside Out 2 stress ball that I'm showing you in the camera right there. So that's...
Oh, look at... Well, there we go.
I need to get my... My anger out, yeah.
There we go. Swaggy McSwaggerton. Okay, now, speaking of things that make us cry, did you pay attention at all to the third season finale of Bluey? For me, it was fascinating to watch social media, the number of adults who posted pictures of themselves sitting there with their kids watching The Sign, that was the name of the season 3 finale, with just tears streaming down their faces.
I do not watch Bluey regularly. I didn't see the special, but yeah, everybody said it was amazing. Mm-hmm. I don't have children, so I don't have the same.
But you have a
I can't tap
dog.
Into the same well.
You have, you have Nova, the
That's
wonder
true.
Dog, you know? Well, all right. Anyway, well, just to sort of clue you in, folks, Bluey usually is made up of, an episode is made up of 4 7-minute long cartoons. This time around, the folks at Ludo Studios decided they were going to try something different. They were going to do a 28-minute long episode and tell one complete story. And what's been kind of interesting is it's been suggested that this was the trial balloon for a Bluey feature that might be coming from these folks further down the line. But basically, it was about how the Heeler family was getting ready to move because Dad Bandit had a job opportunity, and the wife Chili is not happy with this, but neither of the kids, Bluey and Bingo. And in the end, Bandit opted to do what was right for his family rather than his career. And what's interesting is, in fact, you can watch the 2-minute long end of this episode, which is when the word sign, the sign, comes into play. But it's interesting. It's done just with music, not a single piece of dialogue, full of feels. But the other thing that I find fascinating about Bluey is that it debuted on ABC, the Australian broadcast company, back in October 2018. Disney picked up the international rights to the show less than a year later, June of 2019. And, the smart money has been for quite a while now on Disney bringing these characters some way into the parks. And yet it is.
I was going to ask you about that. There's a whole Reddit thread, Jim, of why they aren't in the parks. All right. So what do you know? Well, I don't think they can put the costume characters in, right?
Well, that's where it gets interesting. And some of this is really about the folks who run the show. Don't get me wrong, but you walk into a Target and there's Bluey stuff. They don't have a problem with merchandising. They don't want to be nakedly greedy. What is the Reddit thread say about this?
Well, it's a lot of parents wondering why they aren't in the park and sort of speculating on why that they aren't there and the licensing agreements, the nature of the licensing agreements. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you had any insight on that, Jim, because people are absolutely mystified.
Well, face it. If you go into, say, Disney's Hollywood Studios, this is a park that doesn't have any problem with, creating a fancy Nancy walk around or Vampirella or that sort of thing. And Disney knows from the mail and the emails and the, all that there is a hunger for Bluey in the parks. But it's just, it's kind of, what's a polite way of doing this? Disney isn't, it's like, what do you mean you have principles? this is children's television. We're supposed to be exploiting them for every dollar. It's like, I don't know. I actually kind of enjoy somebody every so often, tripping up Disney. So, going forward, especially with the discussion of a Bluey feature, just to be interesting to say, well, who might release that movie?
Right, because they're not. they're not in bed with Disney for that. No. So that could be a whole new discussion.
There we go. Okay. Now, we were speaking of streaming services like Disney Plus, which is where you can catch Bluey. While we just talked up Ultraman Rising, which again is showing up on Netflix on June 14th, that streaming service has another animated film showing up just a full month before that. And that is Thelma the Unicorn, and we got a trailer drop for that on Monday. And what did we think of this one, Drew?
I thought it looked pretty cute. It's got a great voice cast.
Oh yeah,
it's got very appealing design. Mm-hmm. This is another Animalogic movie. So this, for those counting at home, this is the third Animalogic movie for Netflix since they have purchased them after The Magician's Elephant and Leo. And yeah, I think it looks really fun and super charming.
I agree, you know, and just the setup here, folks, is it's Thelma is a pony who dreams of being a singer and pretends to be a unicorn to achieve fame. And I have to admit, the reason I have to watch this now is that the antagonist in this is a villainous narwhal. And I honestly, Drew, I think that's the first time those two words have been used in the same sentence in that way. So, I mean, I'm there just for the villainous narwhal.
What is the Disney short with the whale, whale?
The whale that wanted to sing at the Met, Willie, yes.
Yes, yes, there's some very clear kind of design parallels, I feel like, there.
You're not wrong. Okay, so anyway, Thelma of the Unicorn looks like fun, as did the trailer for DreamWorks The Wild Robot, which Drew and I talked about a show or so back, and I was so intrigued by the trailer, I wanted to learn more about the books that DreamWorks optioned, the Peter Brown trilogy of bestsellers, that are the leaping off point for this movie. So week to 10 days ago, we had the power knocked out here at the house for 4 days in a row. And over that time, I entertained myself by reading all three of these books. In fact, the first, The Wild Robot book, came out in April of 2016. The sequel, Wild Robot Escapes, March of 2018, and find the most recent one, The Wild Robot Protects, was September of 2022. And Drew, are you familiar with you obviously got the basic premise from the trailer and the log line, you know, the whole note, yeah. You know, the robot that's shipwrecked on a deserted, you know, island and, you know, has to build relations with wild animals and that sort of thing. I have to tell you that reading these books, it's like, oh, this is going to be such a great Chris Sanders movie. I mean, it's just the material, the raw material from the Peter Brown books is very much in that Stitch, How to Train Your Dragon wheelhouse. This is really a perfect marriage of a filmmaker and material. And the interesting thing is, much like the How to Train Your Dragon book series, there are places for this thing to go if the first film hits. And in fact, what'll be interesting is if they decide to stick with the original ending of the first book, The Wild Robot, it is indeed a cliffhanger, and I just wonder if they're willing to do that. Just go into this knowing this is a series, because if they do, the third film is really kind of a wild departure. I mean, these books are set in the not distant future. I want to say maybe 50 years from now. But the third book is a wild departure because it goes from a story that's told on land to it's an undersea adventure. I mean, you know, like 75% of the story is that story is this robot making its way across the seafloor due to something that's poisoning the ocean. And it's just sort of like, that's going to be interesting if they try to make this into a series.
Well, you'll love to know that, you know, that DreamWorks has had the rights to these books for a little while, but they weren't telling people that Chris was developing it because so many animators were coming to DreamWorks wanting to work on the wild robot that they were saying, yeah, yeah, we still have that. We haven't started developing it, you know, and it's like, it was already way down the road. So it was a very effective recruitment tool, let's say that, to DreamWorks, because animators who wanted to be a part of the project knew that the studio had it, which I think is very fun. And I hope a lot of people did get to work on Wild Robot. So,
And what's interesting about that is, if we shift into this next story here about Boo, the Bureau of Otherworldly Operations. Mm-hmm. This was another one of those projects at DreamWorks that initially seemed very, very promising. It got underway in May of 2009 as the DreamWorks Super Secret Ghost Project. And then, what, changed its name to Boo You. And at that point was supposed to be headed out into theaters in 2012. And by August of 2010, we finally knew that Seth Rogen was going to be part of the vocal cast. And how would you describe it? This was an inverted Ghostbusters, right? It was.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The agents or the Ghostbusters were ghosts and they were sort of investigating other paranormal kind of activity. But there's so much art out there that we've seen. You and I have seen. Yeah,
this is what I bring this up, and partially I bring this up because again, Drew is you know doing his you know art and making of Ultraman Rising book. But Alice just brought this to my attention. My daughter, evidently, when Boo got shut down in 2014, and this was. What, the movie was supposed to be out in theaters in 2015. They had evidently finished the making of book. And, you know, it was in digital form as it was being readied to be published. And this has just shown up online, the making of book for a film that never got completed. Have you ever heard of that before?
No, I had not heard of this. Can she send it to me as well?
I will chat with her this evening and okay. Get you a link. But it was one of these things where it's like and as Drew mentioned, there are because people use the stuff that they had done on Boo for their animation reels to get them work. I mean, there's a surprising amount of this movie you can already watch online. I mean, it's an obviously not completed form, but just the notion of this movie got this close to being released and was this far enough along that an art of book was put together and then didn't happen. It's kind of ironic we're saying this in a world where a Acme versus Coyote, it's in a Baltimore.
Boo,
right, never mind. I just it occurred to me that no, this is not. This is getting surprisingly, familiar. So,
All
right, but anyway, I mean, what fascinated a lot of folks is that the story of why Boo got shut down, and wasn't it that Katzenberg, after 20 years of doing DreamWorks, basically wanted to cash out, or it was ready to move on to other things, and he was getting the studio ready to sell.
Was Boo part of the kind of offloading that happened when they went to Universal?
Well, here's the thing: Boo got shut down in 2014. They didn't sell it officially, complete the sale to DreamWorks to Universal or Comcast till 2016, but. You know, folks I've spoken with, it was sort of the equivalent of, well, you know, you're getting your apartment ready to sell. So, you know, you paint, you patch the holes. And it was just sort of like cleaning up the books, making DreamWorks look as good as possible. But, you know, isn't this also in the same window where they shut down Larkin, the Australian?
Yeah. And this was Mumbai Monkey Me and My Shadow. I mean, there was
so much of,
and I don't know if it was just that so many things, but maybe they stayed in development for too long. I don't know what the issue was exactly, okay. But yeah.
But, I mean, you look at the stuff that's out there for Boo, and just the fact that the villain was going to be voiced by Bill Murray, that he was playing Addison Drake, this sort of ultra-evil ghost that Seth Rogen's Ghostbuster and Melissa McCarthy's What were going after. I mean, there would have been an audience out there just of Ghostbuster fans who'd go to see Bill Murray as a ghost. And you have to think, especially now with Ghostbusters back as a thriving franchise with, you know, the most recent one, Frozen Empire, there would have been an audience for this.
But, yeah, absolutely.
All right. But the other interesting part of the story is that if Boo had stuck with its original release date, Drew, this would have gone out into theaters in June of 2015, head-to-head with the original Inside Out. So,
wow.
Yeah, it would have been interesting. Okay, by the way, we'll be talking more about, at least the sequel to Inside Out, on the second half of today's show. But first, this. And we're back. Oh, speaking of you know, we always like to include some breaking news. And, what was it? Jorge Gutierrez hopped on social media earlier this evening to reveal that I Chihuahua, the animated feature he's had in development for a while for Netflix, is not going forward now. Had you heard about that, Drew? Or?
Yeah, I had heard about that a little while ago. I don't know if he's, I mean, I know that he said he can shop it around, including to Netflix, but, you know, I think that there's a possibility. You and I were just talking because, you know, Dan Lin is back, is now running Netflix film, and he has a relationship with Jorge because they worked on the Billion Brick Race, which, if you're talking about things that are littered with unfinished projects, the Lego universe is certainly rife with that. I mean, I think there's a world in which, you know, the animation community really, really likes Dan. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you're going to see a lot of really exciting stuff happening. And yeah, I just think that, you know, it's a real, there's some positive things that are going to come. But yeah, I was sad to hear that Jorge's movie was kicked out of the line, but yeah, you can get back in it anytime.
Now, speaking of projects get turned off, but projects also get turned on, you had a story over on The Wrap this week about a Meerkat Manor inspired animated feature.
Yeah, could you believe that? Like, what in the world?
I have to say, anything that's going forward at Walt Disney, or excuse me, Warner Brothers Animation, I'm happy to hear about.
Okay, now we have to be clear about this, Jim, because I just got corrected by somebody from Warner Brothers, which is that Warner Brothers Animation is the TV is the TV section. It's Warner Brothers Pictures Animation, which is the feature animation. If that could not be any more confusing, I don't know what is. But anyway.
I remember when it was Warner Brothers feature animation. Yeah. But okay. But this is Seth Green producing this, right? Or
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No filmmakers, no vendor studio, none of that information. But we know Seth is producing it, and it's going to feature quote unquote photoreal animation, which I wonder, why not just watch the show if it's going to be photoreal?
I will say this much. Back in the day when this first debuted on Animal Planet, 2005, oh my God. Nancy and I treated the show, or Meerkat Manor, like comfort food. It was just, the cute little meerkats who stand up and look around for you know threats and then go into their burrows. I don't know if I see a movie there, but, I like Seth Green. We'll see what happens. Before we get started talking about Pixar's next sequel, wanted to mention another sequel of sorts. Back in 2019, the Hilbert Museum of California Art at Chapman University staged the Art and Flair of Mary Blair, which celebrated the career of this Disney legend. And earlier this year, on the heels of the museum's own reinvention, the Hilbert put together another Mary Blair-related show. This is Mary Blair's Wonderland, Imagining Disney's Alice. It runs through September 7th in the museum's Cinema Arts Gallery, which I guess is a new space at the museum. But had you heard about this one, Drew? Or
no, I didn't know about this. I heard that you and Lynn were trying to get some Mary Blair art from that auction the other day.
Don't get me wrong. I'm happy for the members of the Davis family who I'm hoping this windfall will go to, because I want to say they had one of their, I guess, the highest proceeds for a Disney-related auction. It was over $3 million. But yeah, just to watch some of the prices that these pieces were commanding were stunning. And it was just sort of like, leave some scraps for us. So, all right. Anyway. Yeah.
Well, the last time I was at the Academy Museum, I got these. My mom was with us, and she bought it for us. Mm-hmm. Have you seen these like giant Mary Blair wood cutouts of animals?
Oh no! Oh, that sounds cool.
They're really, really great. I'll send them to you. Send you pictures. But it's like a zebra, a giraffe, and an elephant, and they're just like,
those sound cool.
The most beautiful, cutest little things. Mm-hmm. So good. But yeah, She was an interesting person.
She was. She was. I've heard many stories from Mark and Alice about Mary over the years, and sometime got to share some of those. But all right. By the way, speaking of artistic individuals who were worthy of repeated recognition, on the heels of their recent Oscar win for The Boy and the Heron, which took home this year's Academy Award for Best Animated Feature, it was just announced that Studio Ghibli will receive an honorary Palme d'Or at this year's Cannes Film Festival. And by the way, that's the highest prize awarded at this International Film Festival. This year will be the 77th edition. And what's especially interesting, Drew, is this is the first time the Palme d'Or has been awarded to a collective group of artists rather than an individual. I mean, for example, there'll be another Palme d'Or awarded at this year's Cannes Film Festival for George Lucas in recognition for, everything he did, Indy, Star Wars and the like. Cannes this year, by the way, folks, is being held from May 14th through May 25th. And Pixar has a long association with this film festival. In fact, last year, Elemental held its world premiere out of competition, right, at Cannes?
Yeah.
On the last night of the festival. And by the way, Elemental was the fourth feature film from Pixar to be presented at Cannes. First was Up. We then had Soul. And then there was a little film, Inside Out. And, okay, so now to pivot to Drew's discussion of Inside Out 2, this sequel was basically set up with the original film, right? I mean, there was that little vignette toward the tail end where Disgust is standing next to the giant new control panel inside of Riley, and she's looking down the line at things, and it's like notices something and it says, "Hey guys, what's puberty?" And what was Joy's response? That is like, "I don't know, probably not important." And then the very final words of the film again, Joy was, "Riley's 12 now. What could happen?" So, what does happen, Drew? What can you tell us?
Well, what's interesting is one of the scenes that they showed us in that first 30 minutes was a scene where they are putting in the new console, which you will love, Jim, because you get to see the little room where all the emotions sleep and all of their beds are very different. And, Fear has 12 nightlights around his bed and Joy has a little ceramic bing bong, you know, on the shelf next to her bed. And so they come out and then they're installing the new panel, and the emotions all come in, and all the emotions are really fabulous. Mm-hmm. But in my piece, I wrote about an emotion that didn't make the cut. And you'll appreciate this, Jim, because we had a great session with Jason Diemer, who you will know as like one of the great Pixar character designers, designers. Yeah. And he put up a image and there was an extra emotion. And he was like, oh, I didn't have time to Photoshop that character out. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I become obsessed with this character and I bring it up to Kelsey and Mark Nielsen. Mm-hmm. And the character was shame, which was very interesting. And she was going to be not only embodying shame, but also be the villain of Inside Out 2, which is very interesting. Yeah.
Now, in your piece for The Wrap, Kelsey talked about how that version of the film with her as the villain got pretty far along.
Yes.
But talked about how they'd screen it for people, you know, and the notion was it was such an intense story that, you know, it's like, what'd you think? Oh, it was great. Do you want to see it again? Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just, you know, and the notion that ultimately Kelsey wanted to make a movie that you would enjoy and want to watch again. So shame had to go.
Yes. In The Room, I didn't include this in the piece, but we joked that it would have been the zone of interest of Pixar films.
Okay.
That it was just it just left everybody with a really bad vibe, you know.
Wow.
So yeah,
okay, that's an interesting comparison. I was just watching that the other night on Max, and oh my God, you know, the banality of evil. And again, you know, with Jason, you know, having done the design work, I'm sure it was a very appealing looking shame or very distinct.
And it was so distinct that when I went into my meeting, my interview with Mark and Kelsey, I actually drew the character and I said, who was this? And they said, oh, that was shame. Mm. So that's how kind of indelible the character design was. Yeah. We'll see if any of this make, and as we're talking about Art of Books, we'll see if any of this makes it into the Art of Book this time.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
Now you also talked about another character that fell off the table, Guilt, though. Can you tell the gag that, you know, particularly was going to make Guilt memorable?
Yeah. So Guilt was going to come into the mind room or whatever, and they were going to be concealed behind a stack of baggage that you could never see Guilt because they were always behind this giant stack of baggage. And, you know, there are a couple of hidden emotions that do make an appearance in the movie that have not been advertised. So I will just tease that there are a couple that did make the cut that are very fun.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's just fascinating. You know, they had 9 more characters at one point, which would have just been so unruly. But it's interesting.
I have to admit, in fact, that's what I so enjoyed of you. And by the way, folks, well worth chasing down this piece because Drew talks at length, I mean, for example, about, well, you know, it just the Gen Z emotions. Was it Amy Poehler who sort of came up with that handle for them, right?
Yeah. So that's what was interesting, too, about those 30 minutes was that these new emotions are kind of the bad guys because they kick out, you know, they kind of like send the original emotions away who we've had this huge connection with. So we're kind of like, oh, my God, who are these people? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, Amy Poehler said they were the Gen Z of emotions. It's ennui, angst, or anxiety, envy, and embarrassment. So, yeah. Okay. Amazing vocal performances. And I love, too, that Adele Acharpala, I'm not going to say her name right. Adele from Blue is the Warmest Color is playing ennui, who played Ember in the French translation of Elemental. So they said, you were so great. Let's bring you in. Yeah. So it's very cool.
So cool. Okay. I also heard Mark Nielsen, the producer of this, you know, you were just talking about casting the voices for the film. And obviously, Maya Hawke is the voice of Anxiety. Did he share that story about, you know, how she auditioned for the role while he was on vacation?
Oh, yes. He was in Walt Disney World, I think, right?
He was. You know what? He actually was.
And yes, he, that this is all coming back to me, Jim. He went,
yep.
You know where this is, in between Mexico and Norway, right? Or where, what's the, mm-hmm. there you go backstage and there's like a little, a very 70s little cafeteria and you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah. That's where he took the call. Yeah. Which I think is very, very funny. Sort of if you go behind where they do kind of character interactions right there next to Mexico. Yeah. So that's where he took the call, Jim, and that's where she did her audition. Isn't that funny?
That is funny. That is funny. And the other thing I enjoy is that if you go over the voice cast for Inside Out 2, you've got no less than three folks who work with the Muppets, Dave Goles, Frank Oz, and Kirk Thatcher. They're voicing characters in this. Anybody leap out for you for cameos in this?
Or? I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but yeah, just keep your eyes on Riley's mind. She's got some other emotions in there. But yeah, okay. Dave and Frank and Kirk are all mind workers again. Perhaps the same mind worker. Who knows? We don't know what the turnover rate is like in Riley's mind, but yeah, yeah.
There we go. But again, the conceit here, story-wise, is battling with oneself, right? And I mean, the whole notion of these new emotions come in, you know, Riley's entering her teen years,
yes.
Right? By the way, do they announce how old Riley is?
She's 13.
In this thing? I mean,
she's 13. Yeah,
1 year has gone by.
Yes. Oh, so, and the whole thing, you know, the external conflict is that she's at a weekend hockey camp, and she's meeting all these people who she thought were very cool and girls that she's played against in hockey. The opening sequence of the movie, not to give too much away, is a hockey game. So that's how they introduce all the characters again, is like, we've got anger on defense. And, you know, and so each one kind of comes out and does their thing in the hockey game, in service of the hockey game, you know. So, you know, her having to get aggressive on the ice and whatever else. So it's pretty cute. But that's the kind of external drama, is her at this camp away from her parents. She's got her cell phone taken away by the coach. And so, yeah, she's just dealing with her emotions. Yeah, it's really interesting. And it seems like a lovely companion piece to Turning Red, which is obviously a masterpiece and about, you know, the trials and tribulations of teen angst.
And to bring this full circle, I mean, this is something that I recall from when the very first Inside Out came out in 2015. It was Pete Docter talking about his own daughter, Ellie, Elizabeth, who, and it, the notion of she had gone from this really confident kid. And in fact, that's the part of the story I find fascinating, is that, you know, he picked her to voice young Ellie in Up, the girl that sweeps Carl off his feet, you know, just like, you know, this dynamic girl. And then as his daughter entered her teens, she suddenly seemed to lose her confidence. She suddenly seemed to, you know, and to bring this full circle, Elizabeth Docter is now 25 years old, you know, and I would love to talk with her and find out what she thinks of this film and how important it's been to young girls. And I would imagine how many of them will look forward to Inside Out 2. So,
yes.
Anyway, speaking of things that people look forward to, I always look forward to Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, which Drew does with his equally talented partner, Charles Hood. And I know for a while now, you guys have been celebrating the great filmmakers at Paramount, with people like Penelope
Spheris,
that sort of thing. Is that continuing or what are you up to now?
Yeah, it is continuing. Yeah, I think we're this week, we'll get the... I think the first part of Alexander Payne, maybe, which is really fun. Oh. So we talk about Election. Okay. He's actually made three movies for Paramount. He made Election, Nebraska, and Downsizing. And then we touch on all of them. It's a really interesting conversation. And we've got some really good ones coming up that we've recorded but have not revealed yet. So just stay tuned.
Okay.
You're going to want to keep checking in on the directors. It's really fun. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Okay. And speaking of podcasts, we have a few others here at Jim Hill Media we'd like you to check out. We, of course, have Disney Dish, the Mothership that I do with Len Testa. We also have Brian, the show I do with Brian Gunn, looking at Lucasfilm about all things Star Wars. And in fact, he and I will be recording a brand new show of that tomorrow. We also have... the Epic Universe podcast, which I do with Eric Kersey, the gentleman who handles the editing and the producing here at Jim Hill Media. And we also have our new merch podcast, I Want That Too, which I do with Lauren Hersey, Eric's bride. And also want to put a plug in here for Disney Unpacked, Len and Mai's first ever video series, which we are doing with veteran Imagineer Jim Shull for the month of April. We've been talking about Buzz Lightyear and the various Space Ranger spin Astro Blaster attractions around the globe. Next month, we are taking a look at the Disney stunt shows, which that also just got interesting. Did you see they announced the they're going to be calling it soon Disney Adventure World, but they've got the
that is such a stupid name, God almighty. Oh, are you going to talk about the Wild West
well
show?
We will touch on that, but I what I thought was newsworthy is the Lights Motor Action stadium. That they put so much money into that infrastructure that when that show got shut down, they couldn't bring themselves to tear down the stadium. And now they've got a brand new BMX show that's going to be themed around the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland films. I thought that was interesting.
Sure.
Anyway. Also want to remind you, Drew and I are both out in the social media sphere. Drew, these days, still on X, still on Twitter, yes?
Yeah, now I have books to plug, Jim, so, I really got
there we go. There we go.
It's Drew Taylor, like a tailored shirt. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Same thing here. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and over on Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. Final favor here, folks, if you could do Drew and I a solid and head on over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review, well, not just the show you're listening to right now, fine-tuning, but also put in a good word for Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. That would be great. And I think that's going to do it for this week, though, as Drew mentioned earlier in the show, if you come back, next time around, we will talk about the Transformer 1 trailer, which drops tomorrow, right?
I'm ready. Are you ready to go to Cybertron, Jim?
I'll have to pack first.
Okay.
So, all right. Anyway, that'll do it for now, folks. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.